I'm Gregory Berg. The following morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2007. Enjoy. Surely you know by now that this is the 400th anniversary year of the founding of Jamestown. And it is great to have the opportunity, really, again and again, to revisit this crucial moment in North American history. And I am especially excited to do so for the next few minutes with writer and broadcaster Benjamin Woolley. Perhaps you know him for some of the very interesting books which he has written, such as Virtual Worlds and The Queen's Conjurer, The Life and Magic of Dr. John Dee. Perhaps you have seen his work called The Bride of Science, or his participation in the Discovery series 3 Minutes to Impact. His newest book is called Savage Kingdom, The True Story of Jamestown 1607 and the Settlement of America. A most intriguing story, of course, and told in wonderful detail in this book published by HarperCollins. And I am honored indeed to speak with Benjamin Woolley for the next few minutes about his very, very fine book. Benjamin Woolley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I have not read, by all means, all of any of your books, which I'm sorry to say, especially when I look at the titles, which look so very, very intriguing. As we look at the list of titles, we get the sense that you are interested in some especially fascinating sort of hidden corners of world history.
Well, that's right, I think. I mean, the book you mentioned, The Queen's Conjurer, is about this this figure called Dr. John Dee, who's known as a bit of a magician, actually. But he was also, he's a man of many parts, and one of those parts was that he was a geographer, and he was very involved. This is in the 1570s, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I in England. He was very involved in the first attempt to try and settle North America by the English. And in fact, he invented the term the British Empire, this idea of a Protestant empire that would be a counterbalance to the Catholic Spanish Empire, Spain being the superpower of that era.
Very good. Sounds fascinating. As is your take on Jamestown, and I love just in the, I've read the book, but I'm looking at the book jacket for just a moment, because you talk about how 4 centuries ago, 14 years before the Mayflower, a group of men led by a one-armed ex-pirate, an epileptic aristocrat, a reprobate cleric, and a government spy left London aboard a fleet of 3 ships to start a new life in America. I mean, just that description alone lets us know that in many respects, the Jamestown expedition was not all that we might have imagined it to be in terms of the kind of people who came to Jamestown and what sort of skills and experience they essentially brought with them.
Yes, well, I mean, I call them a motley crew. I mean, they are in stark contrast to the way the Pilgrim Fathers are portrayed as having arrived in North America. They seem to be a much more pious bunch of people. I mean, the chaps I was dealing with, I just were a lot more human to me. They were a lot more surprising to me as I began to find out more about them. I mean, they're a rich and, in many respects, peculiar bunch of men who all decided to go, realizing it was a dangerous mission, on this expedition for a variety of motives, from, you know, good motives to the very basest motives, including greed, as people talk about in relation to Jamestown. But I wanted to show that greed wasn't the only motivating factor here. There was a lot more at work that propelled those men out of London and towards across the North Atlantic towards America.
I have to read one of my favorite moments in the book. You say the story of England's attempt to colonize America is not the biblical tale of the elected saints finding a promised land, though some at the time hoped it might be. It is about flawed, dispossessed, desperate people trying to reinvent themselves. It is about being caught in a dirty struggle to survive, haunted by failure, hungering for escape, dreaming of riches, and hoping for redemption.
Yes, and that's a pretty... a potent brew of motives.
No kidding.
And that's why the story is, at one level, quite a complicated story. But I think it's, you know, obviously I'd say this, but it's a very rich story, too.
One thing that is, I think, praiseworthy about your book is that you really try to help us better understand the turmoil which was present in so much of Europe at this point early in the 17th century, turmoil which had a whole lot to do with this motley crew being interested in undertaking this perilous and risky mission.
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose I felt a certain sort of responsibility, being somebody from the old world, if you like, to look at the background that set them off on their expedition. And it's quite a deep background, actually. I mean, in a way, the first draft I did of this book, I went right back to the 1570s and about the religious wars in France, and then decided that was possibly too much background. But Europe, in the latter part of the 16th century, Europe was really in a terrible state. I mean, basically, due to religious wars, there was Northern Europe dominated by England and the Dutch, who have a key role in all this, really, who were Protestant, and then the South dominated by Spain. And France was sort of in the middle, but the English became very bound up in the French Protestants battling with the Spanish and so on and so forth. And when I decided on the title Savage Kingdom, I partly used it. It was, in fact, the term that was used by one of the leaders of the expedition to describe Virginia. But I partly used it really to refer to where they were coming from, because many of them had suffered the savagery back at home. I mean, in England, in France, in Ireland, which at that time was being, if you like, colonized by the English. So that term, that savagery, as it were, was something that they came from, rather than really a description of what they were coming to.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's a side of the equation, as you I think rightly imply, that has really been neglected, or at best, really badly misunderstood by most of us on this side of the Atlantic.
Well, I think naturally enough, you know, people here are interested in what happened after they arrived, because that was what shaped, I mean, I think as many believe, I certainly believe, what shaped the emergence of the United States as this sort of unique polity in this unique country. So naturally enough, when they arrived, that's when, for many, the story begins. But for me, I thought that the background was, because they didn't just arrive with not a single idea in their head why they were there and what they were there to do. They were people who had their own histories and their own story to tell, and they're rich stories to tell. I mean, particularly in the case of perhaps somebody like Captain John Smith, who had fought wars over in the Czech Republic, as it would now be called, for the Holy Roman Emperor against the Ottoman Turk. So he certainly had a lot of history.
Hmm. Help us understand exactly under whose auspices or by what authority this expedition ultimately was undertaken.
Well, there's a sort of intriguing, shadowy figure in the background from at the beginning called Sir Robert Cecil, who was James I had just come to the English throne. He was the King of Scotland, James VI of Scotland. Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, had died famously without marrying and producing an heir. And it was actually in recognition of that Virginia was called Virginia, the Virgin Queen. And James came to the throne and instituted a completely new regime. And Sir Robert Cecil was really the man who made this regime happen. He was the person who had actually organized for James to inherit the throne. And he's a sort of hunchback figure who terrified everybody he met. I mean, absolutely terrified them. And was the word Machiavellian actually came into the English language to be applied to him. It was sort of almost invented for Sir Robert Cecil. And he was presented with this petition by some people who worked for him, suggesting that the English should have another go at trying to settle Virginia. There had been an earlier attempt, famously by Sir Walter Raleigh, that had gone horribly wrong, and they were saying this should be restarted. And they suggested a great public enterprise with the English Parliament behind it and with the members of the public investing in it. And Cecil thought this was a terrible idea, because he'd just signed a peace treaty with Spain and didn't want to start making war with Spain again, basically, because it would be too expensive. So he put in place a private, rather secretive venture, which involved a small coterie of his own people, who he got to raise enough money to send these three ships, barely enough money, I mean, it was very low finance, in the expectation, not unrealistic, that they might find some gold or copper over there. That wasn't a ridiculous idea. It could have happened. And also the possibility of a navigable route through America to the Pacific, because there were actually reports that one of the rivers in the that fed into the North Atlantic was actually salty beyond the tidal reach, which meant it must have access to the sea the other side. So there was still this thought, this hope, that they could reach the Pacific and the riches of China through the middle of America. So that was the chap who set it up, and he set this sort of commercial agenda for the first phase of the Jamestown adventure.
And he liked the idea of keeping it relatively quiet, relatively secret.
He wanted it secret, but he wanted more than anything that it was deniable. So
yes.
So James the First was actually gave an audience to the Spanish ambassador just after they'd left, and the Spanish ambassador, who had pretty good intelligence, said he had heard that there was this mission going over to North America, and didn't the English know that North America belonged to the Spanish? Well, James refused to say one way or the other on the issue of possession, but said he didn't know anything about it, and if there was anybody there, the Spanish could punish them. He wouldn't do anything to get in their way. So they just wanted to deny that what was going on had anything to do with the English government. Hmm.
Three ships ultimately make the trip, correct?
That's right.
And
yes.
and aboard them is such an interesting mix of people and mix of agendas, and that's part of what makes for a bit of volatility in this whole story.
Yes, there was about 100 of them. About 36 were so-called gentlemen, which I think has often been mistaken to mean they were sort of aristocratic, but they weren't. They were from this particular class in England at the time who were, I mean, landowners, basically, but not very rich. And many of these were actually the younger sons of landowners who stood to inherit nothing. So they had to find other ways of making their name, and they thought that this enterprise might enable them to do so. And so there were about 36 of them. They brought many of their servants. They had paid for their own passage over to Virginia. There were some boys, there were some dogs, and there was a few rats too. And they set off on the 20th of December, 1606, down the Thames, arrived in the English Channel, and found themselves stuck there until February the 12th, which proved to be a disastrous delay. Anyway, they finally made it over and reached Virginia, the Chesapeake Bay, in April, the following April, and decided to settle on Jamestown on May the 12th, 13th, which is the reason why there's been this great celebration.
Right.
In Virginia.
By the way, I like you mentioned this delay caused, I think, by weather, which of course ended up causing them to deplete their rations and so on, and made for a much more difficult voyage across the ocean than it otherwise would have been. You talk about for a month the fleet being held in this state of agitated immobility,
yes,
which is a really interesting picture. I love the way you put that.
Well, they were while they were sort of sitting there on the Atlantic, on the English Channel. There was an immediate outburst of infighting. The instabilities that were sort of endemic within this mixture of gentlemen who were leading the mission emerged almost immediately. And the tensions were about many things, but one of the things that they emerged about was the issue of religion. Captain John Smith was trying to defend his friend Robert Hunt, who was the chaplain of the mission. He was the heir responsible for the religious welfare of the men, and theoretically, although he never did anything about it, the conversion of the Indians. And it transpired. I mean, I discovered some papers in the archives of the County of Sussex in South England, these references to Hunt having actually been found guilty of, quote, immorality with his servant, Thomasina Plummer. So although he was accused of being a Puritan, it seems some of his behavior wasn't quite so puritanical. And I think that accusations started to go round the ships as they found themselves stranded in the channel.
Hmm.
And this escalated during the subsequent voyage. To one point, Smith claims, although nobody else mentions it, he was actually threatened with the gallows when they were on one of the islands in the West Indies. And that set the agenda for the subsequent settlement of Jamestown. I should mention that that is by no means unique to these sorts of expeditions. I mean, it happened a lot because there was so much at stake, and it was so difficult to know what would work and what was the right way to do it. Hmm.
You mentioned at one point a wide, barely navigable ocean, which they had to cross, and I can't find it now, but at some point, I'm pretty sure you refer to three wooden eggshells, this fragile fleet. I mean, these 100 or so people were traveling in ships, I think at least one or two of which were not really designed to carry passengers with any sort of comfort at all. So
No, they were merchantmen. They were merchant ships that were designed to carry goods. The passengers just had to sit where the goods were. So there were no luxuries like portholes, for example, down below. One of them probably bore some cannon, but they were just three small ships. They weren't even big by merchant standards at the time. Hmm. They were very vulnerable. Eggshells was the word, rather marvelous term. I can't claim credit for it. It was used by one of the diplomats of the time to describe them. But these ships almost represent a sort of, they're also almost a metaphor for how fragile the whole enterprise was.
Yeah, very well put. We're speaking with Benjamin Woolley. We're talking about his book, Savage Kingdom, The True Story of Jamestown, 1607, and the Settlement of America. I hope it doesn't bother you that we have spent now what appears to be the majority of the interview on simply the first part of the book, but that really was partly in design because other things I've read about Jamestown have not taken the time and the care with this first part of the story. It seems to me that this is one of the things that distinguishes your book from many of the others that have been written. And as you acknowledge, I think, right at the top of the interview, because of who you are and where you come from, it makes some sense for your book to have this sort of shape.
Well, I think that's right, yes. I know through my previous work the archives that have these particular records in them quite well. I got to know them through working with the previous books. And in a way, I just loved going back to them and finding new ones and diving into them. It's so exciting when you actually get hold of some of these documents. I mean, there's a single volume in the National Archives in Britain that contains all the documents, all the official documents, rather slim volume, I'm afraid to say, but all the official documents relating to those very first stages, and just going carefully through them and picking through them, it's a very exciting process.
Hmm. One thing that you acknowledge at the top of the second part of the book, a difficulty faced by you and others who want to better understand the settlers of Jamestown and their interaction with some of the Native Americans on the continent, is that those Native Americans left basically nothing at all behind them in terms of any kind of recorded legacy. And in particular, some of those Native Americans who had the most crucial sort of interaction with the settlers of Jamestown. Talk for a moment about that sort of silence, if we want to call it that, and what I'm sure is kind of the frustrating limitation of having to hear their story such as it is solely through the perspective of the Jamestown settlers.
Well, you're right. I mean, the Indian culture was an oral culture. They didn't write anything down. And it means that you rely totally on the English sources in order to understand them. I mean, by the time... I mean, Jefferson was writing, in the early 19th century, he was writing about the Virginian Indians having more or less been wiped out. Their language and culture had gone more or less by then and has completely disappeared now. I mean, there are Indian tribes in Virginia now, in fact, they're desperately trying to seek federal recognition, but they don't speak the language that was spoken by their forebears, and there's no written record about them. This means you're totally reliant on the English, and I mean that is a real problem for a history book. I mean, a real problem, and I try to use various means to deal with it. One of the things, particularly though, that intrigued me in a way was the way that the English had this sort of this love-hate relationship with the Indians, which meant, I mean, they were fascinated by them. And thankfully, they wrote down a great deal about them. Also, importantly, different people independently wrote about them. So you can see, you know, you can match up to see whether or not one thing sort of makes sense, whether it fits in with another thing that's written by another of the settlers. And one of the things I drew, I mean, John Smith wrote profusely about them, and some of it was very good, some of it is slightly doubtful. But there are others who produce this wonderful testimony. There's this chap called William White, who this boy, basically, who arrived in 1607 and found the conditions in Jamestown, like many did, so awful. He went off to live with the Indians. He was a runaway, as they called them. And he eventually came back, and when he came back, he was interviewed, and he gave a very good description of what life had been like for him. I mean, it's wonderful, really. And it provides you with an intimate view, not only of the Indians, but also of the English and the relationship that they had with the Indians, which was oddly close and intimate. I mean, a fascinating relationship in many respects. And I think that that stuff really, for me, enriched the story considerably.
Mm. I was struck by the fact that, if I read your book correctly, that when they eventually reached the shore of North America in late April 1607 and a small party goes ashore to sort of take in the new surroundings, you say that as they came back, in the words of one of those settlers, "There came the savages creeping upon all fours from the hills like bears with their bows in their mouths, who charged us very desperately."
Mm.
And apparently that, if we want to call it an attack, or certainly unfriendly encounter, was fought off. But I was a little bit struck that it appears to be the very first day that their initial encounter is this kind of encounter. And but the impression we get is that is taken in stride. I mean, some people might have found that tremendously disconcerting and probably rethought the whole expedition.
Well, they first encountered a group that turned out to be a tribe called the Chesapeake, I mean, after whom the bay is named. They were hostile, and they were hostile. It's because of the geography that they were hostile. I mean, I think they had encountered other Europeans, believe it or not, coming to that area before. And they just wanted to be sure that their land wasn't settled in any way, or that, I mean, I think the hostility, in other words, reflected their relative vulnerability in the position they were in. In fact, that tribe was subsequently wiped out by Powhatan, who was the sort of supreme chief of the whole area, the Senecomico, as the Indians called it, called Virginia, basically. When the English penetrated deeper into the Senecomico, into Virginia, they found sort of a much friendlier, it became friendlier the further they went in, because the people more further inland were interested in trade in a way that the people on the coast weren't. And by the time they settled in Jamestown, the local group were, again, pretty hostile for fairly obvious reasons. But Powhatan himself didn't want to get rid of them because he was interested in their copper, among other things. Copper was a real currency of power in the Indian culture. And he was wanting to develop economic ties, I think, to put it in modern terms. So, I think the English already realized they'd had contacts with Indians. Some Indians had actually been in London in 1603 who had possibly come from the Roanoke area. They'd been interviewed, and in fact some of their language had been jotted down and a little dictionary had been drawn up. So they knew something of the Indians, and I think the reason why they didn't give up at that point was because they probably expected initially a hostile reaction.
Hmm. Yes, and then, as you say, very quickly they began having much, much friendlier contacts. I thought the words of the decree from the Royal Council was interesting, that apparently those who undertook this expedition were advised to take great care not to offend the naturals.
Yes, that was the phrase they used, by which, of course, they meant the Indians. The reason for that was because it was financial, among other things. They didn't want to end up paying for a defensive fort on the banks of the James River. They wanted to have a nice, cheap trading posts that would actually produce goods that could be shipped back to England and sold for a profit. So they saw no benefit in making war with the Indians. And in fact, this became one of the key sort of bones of contention, both between London and Virginia and within the camp, because people like John Smith wanted to be to take the colonial path, if you like. They wanted to take Indian lands by conquest or by buying them, although it remains unclear exactly by what means they were going to do this. But he thought that they should take Indian lands, whereas many back home, and some within the camp, in particular some who were working surreptitiously for this Sir Robert Cecil figure in the camp, wanted to ensure that that didn't develop, that it became a trading station, and a basis for that was having good relations with the Indians.
Well, and apparently the advice had come from someone that the settlers should develop trading relations with the Indians before they perceive you mean to plant among them. That is, to become friendly, to do this trading, and get friendly before it becomes evident that you are here to stay.
Yes, that's right. And one of the reasons why women weren't sent with the original group of 100 or so, they came soon after, was to prevent that impression being left, because I think the Indians would have taken it if there were wives, basically, who came along with these men, that they were there to stay. And they understood. There was this fabulous chap, Richard Hacklett, who provided a lot of the information that they used. He actually drew up the instructions that they used when they came over. He knew from other experiences, particularly Spanish experience, actually, that if you did it gently, as it were, if you could coax the Indians into a trading relationship and prevent a hostile reaction, and as you establish yourself in the land that you're going to plant.
Hmm. Well, of course, the story becomes only more interesting as time goes on, and a story, of course, which is fraught with all kinds of difficulty and tragedy, and one can read about it in remarkable detail in this book called Savage Kingdom, The True Story of Jamestown 1607 and the Settlement of America, published by HarperCollins and the author Benjamin Woolley. Benjamin Woolley, this is just a tremendously interesting book. We should mention that it's extensively footnoted, and an extensive bibliography in the back can allow people to learn still more. But my word, there is so much to learn simply in the pages of your wonderful book. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.